We're ready, guys. We'll start back. A couple of people asked me during the break, said, I write inventory different to the way that you guys have presented it. Am I doing it wrong? I'm here to tell you there's no right or wrong way of doing this. If you're taking some kind of self-examination, you're probably well in front of the majority of people in AA. However, maybe you want to have a look at the handouts that you got and maybe just have a crack at doing it that way today and see what happens. We're after a new experience. We've said that prayer at the start. You know, I want to have a new experience with that. So maybe just have a bit of an open mind and have a crack at doing it this way. We're not here to tell anyone they're doing it right or wrong. The worst thing you can do is sit there thinking, oh, I'm doing it all wrong. I think if you write an inventory, you're ahead of the game. Yeah.
And again, we're here if anybody's got questions. You know, come up, ask us. Happy to, you know, on the whiteboard or on a bit of paper to try and help out. Because, you know, it's a simple process for complicated people. It's not a complicated process for simple people. So we don't want it to be any more difficult than what it was meant to be. So we're going to go through fears, the sex conduct inventory and step five in this session. Want to try and knock it over at least probably in an hour, just maybe a little bit more than an hour, but it wouldn't be too much more. And then at that point, everybody will get an opportunity, go off, start writing inventory, those get rid of the grosser handicaps or the blockages that are there today, and hopefully share some with somebody. We'll have some lunch, and then I think we meet back after lunch when we all look done, and we'll do six and seven. So, do you want to read?
Yep. So, bottom of page 67. Where do you want me to go to?
To the end.
To the end?
Yeah.
Okay. Last paragraph. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was as good as far as it went, but it did not go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role that He assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologise to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologise for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear.
Thanks, Chris. So again, now I'm asked to do a fear inventory. And so the fear inventory, and he refers back to the example that he had on his own example on page 65. In that third column, he's indicated some fears in brackets there, and he talks about fear when referring back to that. I think there's a number of different acronyms that you sometimes hear around fear. One of them you won't hear from me because there's a sign behind me that says I will abide by what I'm supposed to abide by. The other is false evidence appearing real, and I think that's a very good metaphor for probably where I'll try and take this. Fear is something that that seems to be a paralyzing, immobilizing component of my makeup that causes me all sorts of problems. There are different kinds of fears, and there's certain fears that are okay, and there are fears that are very destructive. Example. Joe and Charlie always used to say that my car has fear indicators in my car. They're called red lights that come on to tell me to do things. They're there for a reason. It says it's hot. I need to put water in the radiator. It says I need fuel. I need to put fuel in. They're indicators in order to cause me to take some action and do something. There are also fears that I have which are natural fears. I have the fear of falling off buildings. It stops me from stepping off buildings. I might have the fear of spiders, it stops me from picking them up. I might have the fear of snakes, it stops me from patting them. They're quite normal kind of fears. But I don't believe that that's the kind of fears that I'm asked to be dealing with in the resentment, in the inventory process that's outlined here. The fears that I'm asked to deal with are these ones that appear to me to be false evidence, but to me they look very, very real. He says that this thing of fear is like an evil and corroding thread. You know, he talks about the fabric of my existence is shot through with it. You know, it's a very old term which refers to how they used to make fabric back in the day, and they would shoot a different coloured thread down that fabric, and that fabric was called shot fabric, and that fabric would be highlighted, or that strand would be highlighted through that fabric, and it was evident and very obvious that thread was in that fabric. Well, he does the metaphor and he says, well, my life is shot through with fear. I have fear running through my life, and it causes misfortune that I feel that I didn't deserve. He says, but did I not myself set the ball rolling? He says that we ought to think, we think that fear should be classed as stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. I'll tell you in my experience is what fear does to me. Fear ought to be classed with stealing, because let me tell you what it steals. It steals my time. It steals my ability to live in the now. Because fear, when I'm in fear, I am robbed of the moment. I am completely divorced of being able to stay in the right here and the now. He goes through a few instructions of how to do inventory on this. There are a lot of school of thoughts that had all of the inventories to look like the same methodology as the resentment inventories were set out. I'm not opposed to that. I don't think that's a problem. But over the years of probably spending a bit of time in and around this, you know, I've tried to look at the questions and somehow put it into a layout that would reflect what it is that he's talking about. He said back when we were talking about step three, he said selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100, I'm not talking about one fear here, he says driven by 100 forms of fear. I've got lots of fears. I probably didn't know I had so many, but I have one or three. And some of the fears, you know, the 12 and 12 on page 76, he talks about the fear that I would lose something that I already possessed, or I would fail to get something that I demand. I demand a lot. I'm a selfish, self-centered, self-serving individual. I want more. I have a rapacious wanter, and it's never met. I'm driven by all these different fears. So what might those fears be, you know? They could be fear that you guys don't like me, that I'm not enough, that she's going to leave, that she might come back, she might bring the mother-in-law with her, you know? I'm going to die tomorrow. I'm, you know, what's my daughter going to do when she's 21? Is she going to drink? Fear of this, fear of that. And all of those fears fall into that category, if you like, of false evidence appearing real. Is it actually happening? No. But to me, it's very, very real. And for as long as that I'm locked in that and thinking about that, I'm not here. I'm worried about, Chanel's 15. And she's not 21 yet, but I'm already at 21. See, I'm not here. I might look like I'm here, but I'm not here. It's like when I was in blackouts and be driving around and I'd look at people and I'd think, I wonder if they saw me, because they might have seen me, but I wasn't even there, because I don't remember. When I'm in fear, I've lost the moment. I'm not there. And so I somehow... I'm special. No, you guys are not. But I'm special, and I have special abilities. Because I see things a little better than most of you guys do. I mean, I don't mind telling you, and I'm not going to show it to you, but I have a crystal ball. You guys don't get to use it, but I do. You guys might say, I don't have a license to operate it, but I'm going to tell you I do. And I look into that crystal ball, I see stuff. I see stuff that is going to happen. And based on what I think that it's going to happen, it makes me very fearful. And let me tell you, when I look into that, I don't see Tats Lotto. You know what I'm saying here? I don't see great events come to pass for me and countless others in that. What I'm seeing is it's doom, it's gloom, it's dreary, it's all those things that I talked about. That she's going to leave, this is going to happen, I'm going to lose the job, I'm going to go broke, I'm going to be whatever, and so on and so forth. It's false evidence appearing real. But Jesus, my life is just shot through with that kind of behaviour. And for as long as that I'm behaving like that, I am being absolutely robbed of the moment. It should be classed as stealing. With stealing, you betcha, it should be. If the process of the 12 steps was that it says that may you find God now, the only time I can experience God is in the right here and the right now. God is in this moment right now. It's not in the time frame that I'm looking in that crystal ball and seeing down in the future, or me living in the regretful past of what could have been, should have been, what I should have done better, God's in that, I will not have access to God in those time frames. The only time frame that I need to operate in is in the here and the now. So if I was to stand on somebody like my toes and put my finger in their chest. I don't do that anymore. I used to do it a lot after Dean. But if I was to stand on my toes and take me to task on some of those fears that I talked about, that my fear is she's going to leave. And if I was to take me to task on that, she hasn't left today, but if I was to take me to task on that and say, well, how do you know that? Oh, I don't know. It's happened in the past, so based on past experience, I think it's going to happen in the future. But do you really know? This is me. I'm standing on my toes. I'm being questioned by a well-meaning person who's going to try to help me to see the truth on this. And I would go, Jesus, well, I think it. Do you know? I don't know. Right. Well, if anybody would know, who would know? I could flounder around that question for a while, but I think if I was to be honest, I'd say, well, maybe God would know. Precisely. God would know. Now, yesterday, Chris took us through step three, and there was a how and there was a why. When I looked at the actor and I understood what the actor was doing and I understood the nature of what that behaviour was caused by, it was caused by because I was playing God. And I was playing God, that was the how, I had to quit playing God, and the why was because it didn't work. Now, when I'm sitting in fear and I think I know the outcome of a situation, when I'm sitting in fear, I think I've got the crystal ball, I'm projecting that I know what's going to happen in the future, the very thing that I'm doing is that I'm playing God. And the how and why of it is that I had to quit doing that, and the why was because it doesn't work. And for as long as I'm in fear, I am living a way that robs me of the moment, but I will be constantly standing on toes of people and they're going to retaliate. Because fear of finances is going to cause me to go rapaciously after somebody or something or to pursue an opportunity or whatever, because that fear is driving that. Quit playing God. Why? Because it doesn't work. Chris talked about the metaphor of what I'm trying to formulate here of the relationship, you know, of that whatever that relationship looks like, you know, father, child, you know, employee, you know, principal, agent, whatever it, that perceived metaphor looks like, whatever it is, this God type relationship that I'm going to have is that. That's there and I'm here. I'm subservient to that. I've got to quit playing God because it doesn't work. Now, 99.99% of my fears are caused for that exact reason. It's because I'm playing God rather than trusting God. There are other fears that I have that are real fears. Old mate might come knocking at my door because he wants his money. You see what I'm saying here? Well, those kind of fears are going to be solved by making amends. They're, you know, I'm scared of the police. Well, maybe I need to stop being a 21st century farmer and I wouldn't need to be scared of the police anymore. You see what I'm saying here? So it's the direct consequence of how I might be behaving in my life. Those kind of fears are solved by either stop doing that or make an amends. But the... hundred forms of fear that I seem to be plagued with that he talks about are those unrealistic fears of that believing incorrectly, that using that crystal ball. He says, as soon as I am on this different basis and I start trusting and relying on God and I trust God rather than me, he says, I outgrow fear. I immediately outgrow fear. You know, if I'm in fear today, I've got to say, hang on, where are you? You know, Dean talked about it this morning at meditation when he was taking us through yoga, that his whole premise was trying to bring me back to the now. Bring me back to the moment. Because right here and now, none of that's happening. But my mind, I've got to constantly bring it back. Chris will talk about it when we go through step 11 about the watcher. I'm constantly not here. This is where I need to be. My feet need to be firmly planted on the ground in the here and the now, and if they're in the here and the now, the things that I'm worried about are not happening. If I trust God, if I do the work that I need to do, he says that faith means strength. Faith and fear cannot live in the same vessel. If I have fear, I don't have faith. If I have faith, I don't have fear. But I can't have both. He says all men of faith have courage. They trust their God rather than themselves, than their finite selves. So there's a prayer there, you know, that he talks about. We need to ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have me be. So in an attempt to put that into an inventory, you know, set it out as, the fear I have, why do I have the fear, and the question. And the question was at the top of the page. He says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed me? That's the cause of my fear. Right there, self-reliance fails me. I try to overcome the fear with what causes the fear me. It's like, again, we talked about it this morning, I'm trying to fix something that's broken with something that's broken. It just doesn't work. It's like an ant trying to analyse itself on a microscope. It looks in the glass and it ain't there, and it goes and lays down on the plate and it's not there. It can't see itself. I can't fix me. I can't fix something that's broken with something that's broken. Self-reliance is good as far as it goes, but it doesn't solve the fear problem. Nor does that mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life solve any other problem. I can't exert my will to overcome the problems that I create. I have to have help from this power greater than me. I have to somehow be connected to this innermost self, this connection to, rather than not being connected to. What would God have me be? God wouldn't have me being fearful. God loves me infinitely more than I know or could ever imagine. Why do I just put myself down so much that I'm this worthless piece of going concern that is being robbed of the moment and I can't live in the here and the now? A mate of mine used to say, why don't you rub something that's really off-putting on your wrist, and that every time that you have a fear, smell that, and he said, that'll bring you right back to the here and the now. So I just need to be in the here and the now, because the stuff that I worry about isn't happening right now. If I stay in the here and the now, then I experience freedom. Now, understanding that from a theoretical sense doesn't help me to outgrow fear, but it tells me why the fears are caused. What's going to help me to outgrow fear is slowly but surely start to trust and rely more upon this unsuspected inner resource, this vital sixth sense, this God consciousness that's within. You know, God is a part of my makeup. God is within me. It's that fun police. It's always been there. I need to somehow reconnect to that. And everything that we're trying to do again is just to be unblocked. Wilson said he was blocked mostly from worldly clamours, those from outside of himself, stuff that he wanted. I'm blocked off because I'm too full of me. The only way I can find God is to reduce me. And somehow this process starts to remove the blockages that stops me from that. So fears, I get them down, you know, I ask God to remove these fears. If I want to try and find a character defect that's causing most of my fears, it's dishonesty, because I'm not God. But I'm playing God. I've got that thing in my bag. I told you I have. I've got to get rid of it because it just doesn't serve me well. It just tells me lies.
Warning. A sponsor warned me many years ago about living in fear too long. You have a fear and you live in it too long. You start to make decisions based on that fear and you cause the fear to come about. Example, Pete used the example of financial insecurity. I'm so worried I'm not going to have money, so I'm going to stand on people's toes to get as much as I can and try and hang on to it and grip it. And funny thing in this show, when the more you hang on to something, the more it slips through your fingers. But I'm making decisions based on that, and I'm hurting people along the way because I'm so frightened I'm not going to have enough. Frightened of what you people think of me. So I act and behave in a way that I think that you will like me. So I'm not seeing the real me. And so I'm always this actor in the show of life again, putting on this facade so that you people will like me. And that's the way self-reliance fails me, because it's freaking hard to do when you're acting a certain way for every different person in the room to try and so that you will like me. And it asks the question, you know, how would God have me be in that? Well, I think God just wants me to be myself. I'm okay how I am. And it took me a long time to get to that position that I don't have to act in any other way other than who I am. Whether you like me or not, it's none of my business. And so it starts to unravel the fear. But just be warning, I was so frightened my wife was going to leave me because she threatened to leave on many occasions. And I'm so fearful she's going to leave. I start making decisions around that. Oh, well, stuff it, she's going to leave me anyway. So I start treating her like a piece of shit and wonder why she wants to leave. See how we set the ball rolling? It says, didn't we ourselves set the ball rolling? So you've got to be very careful with living in fear too long. I have to see where it's causing me problems in my life and get it down and see where I'm not trusting and relying upon God. So it's a simple, again, it's a simple, very, very simple, written a little bit different from the resentment imagery. But again, doesn't matter how you write it out, as long as you get to see the point where your self-reliance is failing you and you need to, you know, start trusting and relying upon God.
I come to the conclusion, I heard this line once before, and it wasn't in AA, but it was on a program I was watching, and I thought, that's me. That's what I do. And the line was that I spend too much time talking to myself about myself. Too much time talking to myself about myself. I'm not talking to myself about you. I'm not talking about how I might be able to somehow solve world hunger or somehow be, you know, a better person. I'm talking to me about me. And what Chris said there is, you know, that these fears become a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, in psychology, they run hypotheses on certain issues. And my hypothesis around fear is that she's going to leave. And I'm going to test that hypothesis. Now, you've got to understand, this is my hypothesis. I've got to tell you, I'm never wrong. It's my hypothesis, and I'm going to test it. And I will test and test and test and test it to prove to you that my hypothesis is correct. That's what happens, what Chris just said. When I live too long in fear, I'll test that hypothesis until it becomes true. And, you know, rather than trust God, rather than play God, I will blow it up. And so this is, again, fairly pragmatic. Does it mean instantaneously I'm going to outgrow fear? Not necessarily, but let me tell you, when it crops up, I know where it's coming from. I know I'm over here again. You know, and I need to listen to Dean to bring me back to my breathing. Bring it back. Stop the head chatter. Get it back to it like you talked about this morning when we did yoga and meditation. Because in the here and the now, those things are not happening. And that's the how and why. But I've got to quit playing God because I'm playing God when I'm over here. And I need to trust God rather than play God. Now, we're going to have some fun. I don't want you guys to get excited or anything. I'm not calling for volunteers. But we're going to talk about that. All right? No practical demonstrations. We're putting into practical application at once here.
Nothing on the whiteboard.
I'm just putting that up there. We'll be showing no videos here. And forget the wind sheet that Dean's been wearing all day that's got Pornhub written on it or whatever. We ain't going there.
He took it off.
But there will be, we may talk about instances where some of us have ended up in the burns unit because of certain behaviours that now about sex might lead me into. But anyway, that's another story. Again, it's going to be an inventory process. There's going to be 9 questions to tease out the sex inventory. I think one of the most important parts is towards the end of the inventory process for sex, but I might get Chris to quickly smash through it and then we'll get on to the step 5.
Bottom of page 68. Now about sex. Many of us need an overhauling there, but above all, we try to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes. Absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cries that sex is the lust of the lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we don't have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavour for his fare and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbitrator of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. But what can we do about them? We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where have we been selfish, dishonest or inconsiderate? Who did we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subject each relation to the test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mould our ideas and help us to live up to them. We remember always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if you want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realise that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and on our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will learn our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorising, these are facts out of our experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quietens the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache.
Thanks. Beautiful. Sex. Need an overhauling. I'll have an overhauling, please. An overhauling in the mind. So he talks about that, you know, there's different extremes, and you know, I like the part that he says we want to stay out of this controversy. We don't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. I really try and tie that back to the 10th tradition, where you know that I shouldn't have an opinion on other issues outside of my responsibility as an AA member. So he says, well, you know, everyone's had sex problems. That's a fact. Wouldn't be human if that wasn't true. So what can I do about them? So he says, I'm going to review them. How do I review them? I review them, do an inventory. There's 9 questions that he asks in that next little paragraph, if you like. Says, where had I been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate? Whom had I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, bitterness? Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? He said, we got this down on paper. And so in the steps guide that we sort of put together for the weekend, you know, column 1 says, who would I hurt? And again, it's the same as doing any other inventory. I'm going to list the people who I've hurt in that column. And the second column says, well, you know, where had I been selfish, dishonest or inconsiderate? I'll take this down the Burns unit route. So whom had I hurt in that column could be my wife. And where had I been selfish, dishonest or inconsiderate? Well, I could have been selfish and dishonest because I found myself in front of the computer screen. And on that computer screen, I found myself going down a few rabbit holes that I probably shouldn't have been visiting. People might say, well, there's no harm in that. Well, there may or may not be. I'm just telling you how that plays out with me now. I will entertain that, which will cause me to end up at the Burns unit. And then I end up in the third column, where was I at fault? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion or bitterness? Well, did I? I mean, I didn't get caught. But you know what? She may be interested. And I'm not interested. I've already taken care of it and gone to the Burns unit. I'm not really... So all of a sudden, she's thinking, hang on, why is he not interested? Maybe there's someone else. Maybe there's a secret girl who understands. That's later in the book. We may say she understands, he says. I might have been the French woman, Ross.
Cautionary tale.
That behaviour, for me, causes a harm because it arouses jealousy, suspicion and bitterness. The next column asks me, what should I have done instead? Maybe not visited the Burns unit. In reflecting on that, so I go through each encounter, if you like. We might group them together, one night stands, sex workers, whatever it might turn out to be. And I work my way across that page, the same as we do in the same as I've done in every other inventory process. And I think that one of the most important questions in these 9 questions that he asks is the last one that says, what should we have done instead? What should I have done instead? Not going to the Burns unit. Not going to the massage parlour. Not going to a massage place for a massage and it went further. Not had that one night stand. Not led that girl along and told her that I loved her when I didn't because I wanted the outcome, etc., etc., etc. Being monogamous in a relationship, so on and so forth. And he said, I get all this down on paper. And he said that what I'm trying to achieve with those bullet points of what I should have done instead is to somehow try and bring those together in a laser focus in maybe just a little statement. Maybe one line, maybe 2 lines, maybe just a little sentence. And he describes it as an ideal. What do I want to be? Who do I want to be? What kind of person do I want to be? How do I want to be going forward? My ideal that I'm trying to shape here, this sound and saying ideal that I'm trying to shape, is not what my ideal is. 5'11", blonde, owns her own boat, very wealthy, maybe French. I don't know, maybe not. So the ideal is not talking about my ideal person, but my ideal of who I want to be going forward based on past errors and past mistakes. You see, one of the 9-step promises says, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. My past mistakes are my greatest assets going forward. Clancy always used to say, making mistakes is not the problem, but defending the mistake is the problem. As a human being, I'm never going to rise above being a human being. I'm going to make mistakes, but as long as I don't defend them, and I use them as opportunities to learn from. And this process of doing inventory in this manner, looking at this particular subject, gets me to look at those mistakes and use those mistakes to try and shape a better version of me, to come up with an ideal which is a mirror that I hold up to me. If my ideal might be visiting massage parlours, having multiple girlfriends and going to the Burns unit 4 times a week, then that's my ideal. But if it isn't my ideal, and my ideal might be being honest, being loving, not adulterating, whatever my ideal turns out to be, that becomes the mirror that I hold up to myself and hold myself to account with. So if my behaviour starts to get out of track, I say, well, hang on, this is what I wrote. And if I was to help a guy in sponsorship, I'd say, and then you say, I've got troubles in personal relationships again, I'd say, well, hang on, dig out that thing you wrote for me. Let's just revisit that. Is your behaviour reflective of what you told me that you wanted to be? You wrote, that's yours, not mine. I'm just, you know, being the mirror for you. Because that ideal is the thing that is going to help me to be a better version of me going forward. He says, you know, I avoid hysterical thinking and advice, and maybe I might fall short of that ideal. Remember, you know, we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. No one among us, no one at all, is going to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. And then somebody at the back of the audience yells out, "What's the point?" The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. You know, the 12 steps are guides to progress. The only one I get to do 100% is that first step, and the remaining 11 are guides to progress. I measure my progress based on what they look like. I measure my progress in this area based on what my ideal has... I wrote, it's my ideal that my ideal states that this is who I want to be. What if I fall short and I stumble? What if I drift back down to the Burns unit again? You know, does it mean we're going to get drunk? Maybe I've done worse. Does it mean I'm going to get drunk? He says, well, some people might say so, but that's maybe a half-truth. He said, depends on my motives. He says, if I'm sorry for what I've done and I want to... If somehow I've fallen short and I've made an error and I've got to fix it up, that's okay. You know, maybe that doesn't give me a pass here. Just please, this is not a pass out here. It's not like after 50 years sober you can go out and have a night on the. You know, there's no pass out here. But the thing that it gives me is that it gives me the ability to see where I am wrong, and to try and do a little better. He says, but if my conduct continues, if I continue to go out and behave in a manner that is contrary to that ideal, contrary to the person who I saw in black and white when I did inventory, contrary to the person who I learned about by seeing all of the what should I have done instead, he said, I am sure to drink. And he makes a very, very clear statement. He said, we are not theorising. This has been born out of our experience. These are facts. It's a warning out of our experience. So he says, well, let's sum up about this. I pray for the right ideal. Hopefully I'll formulate a right ideal, not a wrong one. And for guidance in questionable situations. You know, for sanity and strength. You know, that going forward, you know, my behaviour, I subject each relationship to this test, is it selfish or not, when I look at who I'm trying to be in this situation based on that ideal. I ask for sanity and strength to do the right thing. And then he says, but you know, if I've still got trouble here, if I'm still in a bit of strife, he says, I better turn my help to somebody who I can help. Turn my thoughts to somebody that I can help. You know, Wilson said it in his own story. He said he was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment, which almost drove him back to drink, but he'd go to the old hospital, and he said that talking to a man there, he was amazingly lifted and set on his feet. He described it as a design for living which works in rough going. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, in the theory of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is one stock-in-trade answer that solves all problems. Go and help somebody else. Because when I'm trying to help somebody else, I'm forgetting about me. See, if I've got a sex problem, I go and try and help somebody else, and that quiets, he says, the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. You see, when I'm thinking about you, I'm not thinking about me. My problem is that I think too much about me, and the more I can think about you, my problem dies through neglect. It atrophies, because I don't give it any time, I don't give it any room in my thinking. Working with another alcoholic always saves the day. So that's the three inventories. The three inventories are resentments, I get to see the truth. Fears, again, I've got to see the truth about that and realise that lack of faith is my dilemma there. And you know, I need that faith. I need to trust God rather than play God. And this behaviour that I've now been able to uncover. Even some of the things that I might have thought, well, that's acceptable, it's not quite playing around, well, if you want to justify that, I'm fine with that. But for me, you know, I've had to look at those things from that angle, through that lens, and realise that if I cause jealousy, bitterness and suspicion by doing whatever I'm doing, it's wrong. And I've got to stop it. So I just might read this, and then I think Chris is going to take us through step five. If we have been thorough, fearless and thorough, about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analysed our resentments. I've written and analysed. I've written them down. I've analysed them. The resentments are gone. I've got to the exact nature of my wrongs, looked at it from an entirely different angle. It's not their fault. I did it. I caused it to happen, or how I've thought about it since it happened. I've listed and I began to comprehend their futility and their fatality. I understand that resentment's the number one offender. It's going to drive me back to drink quicker than anything else. Shuts me off from that sunlight of the spirit. I've commenced to see the terrible destructiveness. I began to learn tolerance, patience and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look at them as sick people. And that compassion prayer, that sick man's prayer. We've listed people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to go out and straighten fast if we can. So it sort of segues me a little bit into steps 8 and 9 here. Some of the people I resent, some of the people I've harmed are going to end up going onto an 8-step list. Some of the people I've feared, maybe I've done some stuff there as well that might make it onto an 8-step list. He said in this book you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision, which is that third step decision, we did it as a group, we did it as a collective this morning, and an inventory, step 4, of your grosser handicaps, the defects, it's uncovered, discovered, and I've got to see what the destructive nature of it was. He said, you have made a good beginning. He said, that being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks and truth about yourself. And that's the whole reason that I've done inventory. To swallow and digest some big chunks of truth. I've got to see the truth. And all of a sudden, you know, now I've been able to get that down on paper and list it out. So, do you want to recap on any of that, or do you want to go straight into
something? Just a couple of quick things, and then we'll move into step 5. But Pete talked a lot about, I've got to do this 180-degree turn. And often that seems quite impossible because I've lived this way for so long. And the old story goes, if you always did what you always done, you're always going to get what you always got. And so I have to start to see a different way of living. And the inventory process has shown me a different way of living. It's gone from the way I used to act and behave in resentments and gathering posses and staying them in the blame game to start to look at it from an entirely different angle. I've started to change the way that I'm seeing things, and I'm turning that 180 degrees. Same with the fear and the sex inventory is the perfect case study for it, isn't it? If I don't want to change in that area, just keep doing what you're doing, because you're going to keep getting what you got. If you keep struggling with relationships and burning relationships and because of your behaviour, well, if you keep doing that, guess what? You're going to keep drag that into the next relationship. So it's about trying to do things differently, and that ideal really helps in that area. So it's up to you when you're asking to get an ideal on how you want to be in future relationships. I would challenge you, you want to change from the way, if you're burning through relationships, you want to start doing things differently. And so that's how I approach the ideal of how I want to be in my future, because I don't want to be that person anymore. I want to change. I want to align my will to how God would have me be in each of these situations. And it's all part of change. That's what it's all about. I want to see the truth about the stock in trade. I want to see the truth in the way I've been acting and behaving. I want to do things differently. I don't want to keep going on. Otherwise I might as well go through door number one. There's a checklist there that Pete read out too, which is an important checklist really. Bottom of page 70, where it talks about, have I begin to comprehend their future? Have I? Ask yourself that question. Have I commenced to see that they're destructive? Have I commenced to see that these things are causing me trouble? Have I begin to learn tolerance, patience and love towards all people? So it's a bit of a checklist really before I move on to step 5. Because that's where the ultimate goal is to get to, but I have to start to learn patience, love and tolerance towards everybody. That's a far cry from where I was hating the crap out of everyone and blaming everybody else the way I was, but it's part of the change. Alright, we'll move into step 5. We'll just try and pick bits and pieces out of it. It's It's not a big read really, but we'll read some bits and pieces and talk about experiences on it and what it's asking me to do and what it's telling me not what to do. So, do you want to read the first bit, please?
I can. Chapter 6, Into Action. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
Thanks, mate. So we've made the personal inventory. So what are we going to do about it now? I've looked at it. I've analysed it. I've seen it. I've seen a lot of stuff. It's shown me the truth about a lot of stuff. It's shown me that I believe lies. What am I going to do with it? And it says, you know, that the main purpose of it is that we're trying to build this relationship with this Creator. Open the curtains, unblock ourselves from this Creator. So that's the main purpose of it. That's all I'm trying to do, is to try and build that relationship with this Creator and unblock myself. And that's why I just love the prayers in each one of those imagery, because it's about what's the saying that I don't think myself into the right actions, I action myself into the right thinking. So I've got to take the actions even when I don't believe it. So I do those prayers. They're very important in all those three imagery, is that it includes prayer, because I'm trying to build that relationship with this Creator. And you know, from here on in, it's all about, I can't do it, ask. 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 And so it's about that's what I'm trying to do, is build this relationship with this Creator. I've ascertained in a rough way what's wrong. If you're like me, I thought, bingo, I found the meaning of life. It's all here. Boy, was I in for a rude shock when I sit down to do this for somebody else who's got experience in this, can point out other stuff to me. It's going to go on later and to tell us, you know, the criteria for someone to do it with. And bear in mind, this was written in 39. We are so blessed today, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is in a great state, because there's probably, you know, the room's full of people that can hear a fifth step and know what the hell you're talking about. Back 30 years ago, there wasn't a lot of people that if you said, I've got a fifth step, can you hear it? They'd go, well, I don't know about that. What am I going to do for you? And so, you know, it's going to set out a criteria for what we do. And it's going to require some action. You know, from someone who'd never done any kind of self-examination or any kind of confessional stuff, this was all new to me. And so when I'd finished it, there was this big, thank Christ for that. Surely it ends there, doesn't it? But no, I've got to do more. And often that seems, it's going to be difficult. But that's what the fifth step's about. It's about that I have to, you know, me seeing it, God understands it, now I have to confess it to somebody else. A problem shared is a problem half. It's something happens in the fact that I'm actually, we were talking in the car yesterday, and Pete said, oh, I feel embarrassed to tell you this stuff. And that's how we get it. I'm embarrassed to tell you this petty stuff, but that's the stuff that keeps me blocked off. And I just laugh, because I'm the same. I'm embarrassed to tell you, you know, I've been around so many times and this stuff's still coming up. But ultimately, when I share it, it disappears. And so part of the fifth step's about that. So action, and when we've finished it, it says an interesting thing that these are about to be cast out. I missed that for a long time. These we've ascertained in a rough way, we've put our hands on the weak items in stock. Now these are about to be cast out. And part of the process of them being cast out, we think it's steps just 6 and 7, but ultimately the start of the process of them being cast out is to share them with somebody else. I've done the first part of it, I've seen what they are, the defects of character, now I'm going to share them with someone, and then I move on the rest of the program. That's where they get cast out. And so that's the goal of this, is to see where I'm going wrong, admit them, and get them cast out. Pete talked about, you know, the warehouse full of stuff. I've found the damaged and unsaleable goods. I want to get rid of them, and it'll, you can't have a void. They'll be filled with other stuff. All right. Which other part did you want to read, please?
Well, I reckon I've got to do that, but unless you want to cover anything else, it's up to you.
No, that's fine. So it talks about, I'll paraphrase a lot, it talks about that, you know, we want you to find someone. We don't want you to put this off. The worst thing you can do is put this off. You don't do your four steps, throw it in the boot and drive around thinking, oh, I've done that, I'll find someone when I can. They're urging us to get on with it straight away. Don't postpone or evade this. And again, I guess back in 39 when there wasn't a lot of people around, they suggest you did it with a priest, find a closed mouth, understanding friend.
What?
Find, you know, wife. And you may laugh at that. I happily share,
Ronnie did it with his wife.
Yeah, well, I happily share stuff with my wife, providing it's not resentments that I have on her. Paul knows. Because I'm desperate to talk to someone about this, and my wife's been in LLM for 30 odd years, so she understands. And it says, provided I'm not sharing stuff with them that's going to affect them. Okay, so we can do that, but they can't stress the importance that I've got to get, you know, I've got to talk to someone about this stuff. We often laugh, you know, it says a closed mouth understanding friend. And Peter always says, you know, my dog is a closed mouth understanding friend. But I don't think he's going to give me the feedback that I need, because he loves me unconditionally. He's just going to sit there wagging his tail and going, you're okay, except yeah, he is. I want to get some feedback on this, because often, sometimes I miss the truth because I've got a self-centred mind that bends it a little bit. And how do I know that, you know, and Pete talked about it in that sex ideal. I had a sponsee, and I tell him that I use this story because we laugh about it, because he came to me with that ideal about his ideal woman. I wanted to be this, and she's going to treat me this way, and she's going to do this, and she's going to do that, and because he didn't see it. And it wasn't until he shared that ideal that I said, so are you after, is that your sex ideal or your ideal woman? And he looked at me and I said, this is about you, mate. It's not about what you want. And so I need that feedback from someone who can sit there with an objective, not be involved, and look at it from an objective perspective. And often they can see things more clearly than I can when I'm caught up in that stuff. So it's important that I find someone, you know, that understands what it is that I'm about to do. And look, I've heard people that have gone to priests to do it, gone to doctors to do it, paid a psychologist to do it. Again, there's no set. All they say is a closed mouth understanding friend who understands what it is that I'm about to do.
Just continuing along, you know, that's just quickly before we finish up the last part, but just continuing along with that, you know, that they were absolutely scrambling to come up with people that could perhaps do that. Chris said today, I'm absolutely privileged that there are rooms full of people who fit the criteria. And I guess we're talking about sponsorship, I guess, at the end of the day. If I'm sitting down doing a genuine first, fifth step, well, it would generally be with my sponsor. So you know, what would that person look like, you know? And we've always, you know, teased ideas, because it's not really talked about much in the textbook, but what would a sponsor be? What would the qualities of that sponsor be? And I think on page 18 where he talked about, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who's properly armed with his facts about himself. That's who I need to share it with at the end of the day. I can share it with a priest, but he doesn't fully understand and approve of what I'm driving at. It becomes, like Chris said, it's a confessional, has certain value. But the person that I will get most value from is going to be the ex-problem drinker who's properly armed with the facts, who will argue with me and say, well, hang on, you said that you were self-seeking here, you said that you were selfish here, but can't you see you were dishonest? And I'm, wow, blah, blah, blah. You know, I get that perspective
that I don't ordinarily see myself. You know, it's like two people looking at the same car crash, and one's on this corner and one's on that corner, and they see things totally different. The last little piece of that is that this is from Dr. Bob's nightmare. And he said of far more importance was the fact that he was talking about Wilson when he first met him. He was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about with regards from alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. I need to find somebody who talks my language. I will get most benefit. I'm not saying, as Chris said, look, you can talk to a psychologist, you can do this, you can do that, but most benefit, I believe, is going to come from that ex-problem drinker who's probably armed with the facts about himself, who understands and has found this solution. And so...
And there was another death threat in there too. It says if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. So that's how important it is. We can't skip this vital step. It's an important part of the process. So, you know, there's a few death threats in the book and that's one of them. So what do we do? You know, a lot of people took that bit about until they told someone their life story, went directly to there and think that you have to write a life story. It's not about, it's your story with regards to those three inventories.
Correct.
That's what your life story is, with regards to those three inventories. So it tells us what we've got to do. It says, when we've decided who is to hear this, our story, we waste no time. We've written inventory and we're prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realise that we're engaged upon a life and death errand. This is a life and death errand. You know, the consequences of not doing it far outweigh the consequences of doing it. Most people approach this way, will be glad to help. They'll be honoured for our confidence. And I know I can speak, every time someone asks me to do this, I tell them I'm absolutely honoured to hear this. It's an actual honour to hear somebody's fifth step because they're entrusting in you their stuff, you know, so it's an absolute honour to hear a fifth step, and I get more out of them than what they do. I don't know about you, I get more out of them than what they do because I sit there going, I've done that, that's the way I feel. So it's an absolute honour. So the instructions are, it tells us what to do. It says we pocket our pride and go into it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And on the page before it says we've got to be careful not to hold on to stuff. Every dark cranny means every dark cranny of the past. In fact, I learned a technique, and Danny won't mind me sharing. I was listening to Danny's fifth one. I heard this guy say, he said, you know, he gets the dark crannies out the way to start off with. Because if you do that, the rest of the inventory is easy. And so I was listening to Danny's fifth step one day, we were going through it, and he had all his stuff ready to start reading it, and I said, what's the dark crannies, mate? And he was shocked, weren't you, Danny? He went, but I said, no, what's the dark crannies, mate? And he's all like this, and after he told me stuff, it was like that, and the rest of the inventory was easy, wasn't it, Danny? Well, that's the experience that I had. And so sometimes getting those dark crannies out makes the rest of the process very, very easy. It's just a technique that I learned. Because we all got secrets, yeah. We've all got stuff that we're going to take to the grave and not tell anyone. And that's the stuff that makes us sick. That's the stuff that keeps us blocked from the sunlight of the spirit. It keeps those curtains drawn. So you've got to be careful about dark crannies because they're the things that are going to trip you up. I remember hearing a guy, and I'll diverse a little bit, talk about he was 25 years sober and he busted. And I said to him, mate, what happened? He said, there was stuff that I kept secret that I wasn't going to tell anybody, and it's just come back to bite me in the arse. So be careful about dark crannies. Illuminating every dark cranny. Once we've taken this step, withholding nothing. Withholding nothing. Now these are the checklist, if you like, or the things that should start to occur. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us, we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. So there's a checklist of your life. If you're not feeling those things, I would challenge that maybe you're hanging on to stuff that you're not being totally honest. And sometimes they do come you know, an hour later or 2 hours later, but they should materialise. Those things should materialise. You know, confession's a big... For me, it was like a huge thing. But we laugh. I shared one of my first imageries with Peter, and I said I laugh about it now because it was... I like padding the expense account. It sounds so much better than stealing $50,000, doesn't it? So I laugh because I only told half-truths. It was the best I could do at the time. I'm happy to admit that stuff now, but you know, I've got to tell the whole truth, and that stuff starts, and I start to realise I've become free. I start to get that experience that I don't care about my past anymore. It doesn't have any hold on me because I'm honest and open about it, and I can use that stuff to help other people. So I'm not looking over my shoulder anymore for those skeletons to come out of the closet, because they're not there anymore. I'm happy to share whatever, because we're human beings before anything else. We all make mistakes. I'm never ever going to be perfect. So the checklist is that, you know, those things should start to occur. I remember leaving, you know, and again, we did the Joe and Charlie, the tick, 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 and Pete was saying before, oh, you know, it was lame, but it started me on the process that I could do this. And I remember leaving, we sat out front of Manresa in his car for a couple of hours, and I remember walking away, and that Toyota ad where the guy jumps up and clicks his feet, and that's how I felt. I felt this huge weight off my shoulders. I felt this connection to something in AA that I'd never felt before. And so that stuff, and it's happened every time I've done a thorough fifth step. I felt that sense of ease and comfort, and I felt that connected to another human being. I felt that connected to all you guys. I'm not apart from anymore, I'm part of. And so that stuff should start to materialise.
Last bit. He gives us an hour. He says, returning home, I find a place that I can be quiet for an hour. So it's about the only time in the book that he actually gives me a break. Joe and Charlie used to say it was like pulling into a wayside stop. I get to pull off the road for an hour, have a rest. So I go home and I review what I've done. He says, taking the book down from the shelf, I review the first 5 proposals. This is where I'm going home to sit with God. I'm going to review the first 5 proposals. I'm looking at those first 5 steps. You know, I look at that first step. Was I fully surrendered? Had I fully conceded? I go through that second step. Was I open to that concept? Do I understand that, you know, I need to have that? You know, what did that third step decision look like? Was I entirely ready? Did I do that? Was I fearless and thorough? Did it all come out? Is there crannies that I hang on? I need to call you about something. I'm taking those calls. You know, the guy's gone off and, oh yeah, look, there was just something I omitted. I need to get it out. You know, so I review those first 5 proposals. And he uses a building metaphor as a means of me trying to get across that. I look at what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to build an arch through which we're walking to freedom. And we've seen the picture of the archway in the handout, the metaphor of the structure, the spiritual structure that I'm trying to build. And he asks me 4 questions. He says, is my work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have I skipped on the foundation, the cement put into the foundation? Have I tried to make mortar without sand? And you know, and so I just, if I can go home, I sit with God, if I'm okay, I don't have to make that call about the dark cranny that was omitted, and I thank God from the bottom of my heart, then I'm ready to go on with the rest of the program. So that's the end of step 5. That's as far as we're going to go. Guys, we've got lunch, we've got time to write, we've got time to find somebody else. If we need to shift times a little bit here and there to enable people to do things, there's nothing set in concrete here. It's very fluid. So, guys, thank you for the morning session.
Yeah. Just on that hour, I can't emphasise enough. For years, you know, doing lots of this kind of work, skimped over that hour. I thought, oh, yeah, no worries, don't have to worry about that. And the moment when we started going through this book, taking it word for word, literally following exactly what the directions say, it is unbelievable how much stuff will come up in that hour. It is unbelievable. I've worked with a guy, we're going through it, his resentment lifts, he's got a wife, and halfway through the resentment list I'm thinking, I haven't seen his wife mentioned once. Now I'm married, and I know... the person I live with is going to be the brunt of cop the brunt of my resentment. So I said, so you haven't mentioned your wife at all? He said, no problems in that area. Okay. So I probed him a bit to try and get him, but he couldn't see it. He went home and took the hour and he rang back and he said, I've got some more writing to do. Very important to take the hour and go over those first five proposals. Make sure that you are setting in stone what it is that you're trying to build here. Skimped it for a lot of years and started doing it and had great experiences out of it. So make sure you take the hour.